So this is the third parsha in Chumash Vayikra, and Vayikra is a very difficult Chumash for many people. The laws of Karbanos are complicated, even to understand on a very simple level. And of course, the spiritual meanings are often very elusive. But skipping ahead, the parsha begins, is the eighth day. Now, what is the eighth day? Because starting from the 23rd of Adar, there were 7 days of preparation, which you might call them pre-dedication ceremonies. Every one of those 7 days, Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan and then disassembled the Mishkan. And there were special korbanos that were brought. But on the eighth day of consecration, so the eighth day of consecration is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. On Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the Mishkan was put up permanently, and that is the first time that the Kohanim were inaugurated into the service, because for those 7 days, Moshe was the Kohen. And Moshe was bringing korbanos for Aaron, to kind of make Aaron kosher to be a Kohen. On the eighth day, that's the very first time that the Kohanim are inaugurated. So again, the way Rashi learns, based on Chazal, the eighth day of Miluim is the preparation, the eighth day of Miluim is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Now, I want to point out, the Eben Ezra actually argues, the Eben Ezra learns that the 7 days of Miluim began from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and the eighth day is the eighth day of Nisan, and you'll see the Eben Ezra has a very interesting raya. In other words, our problem basically is this. Our problem in terms of interpretation is, we know that the Mishkan was built or finished on the first of Nisan. That's a pasuk in the Torah itself. We know that there were 7 days of preliminaries with an eighth day of consecration. The question is, what is the relationship between the 7 and the 1 and Rosh Chodesh Nisan? Rashi Shita, in light of Chazal, is that Rosh Chodesh Nisan corresponds with day 8, and since Rosh Chodesh Nisan corresponds with day 8, the 7 days of consecration began on the 23rd of Adar. That's Rashi's opinion. The Eben Ezra says Rosh Chodesh Nisan corresponds with the first of the 7 days of consecration, which would make day 8 the 8th of Nisan. But whether we understand the 8th day as the first of Nisan or the 8th of Nisan, the Torah does go on and tell us that in spite of the great joy at the dedication of the Mishkan, a very great tragedy happened that day as well, and that is Aaron's two oldest children, Nadav and Avihu, brought, and I'm just going to quote the pasuk right now, brought a foreign fire, an esh zara, which they were not commanded to bring. And as a result of this foreign fire, the Torah tells us a fire came out from God, and it consumed them. And Chazal described this as an internal fire, meaning their bodies were intact and their clothing was not burnt. But so to speak, their neshamas were destroyed. And as a result, the great joy of the dedication of the Mishkan was marred by the deaths of Nadav and Avihu. And the Torah records Aaron's response, that Aaron's response was silence. Aaron did not complain, Aaron did not openly mourn, etc. He accepted the decree of God, no matter how difficult it was. So one of the big issues that the Mefarshim discuss, that Chazal discuss, is what is exactly the reason for the death of Nadav and Avihu? So in truth, there's a plethora of reasons. Are those reasons consistent with what the Chumash itself says? Rashi brings that Nadav and Avihu had drunk wine or some type of intoxicating drink before they entered the Mishkan. And for that alone, they are deserving of death. And Rashi proves the point by pointing out that right after Nadav and Avihu die, the Torah records that a Kohen should never drink any wine or liquor when he enters, lest he'll die. Of course, in a sense, There's something almost illogical about that reasoning. You know, the Constitution, the United States Constitution, has a clause that prohibits the enactment of what is called an ex post facto law. An ex post facto law is a law that criminalizes behavior after you've already engaged in it. Let's say you did something which was okay when you did it. We cannot pass a law that says, oh, anyone that walks in sneakers during the day is liable for a fine. You can make such a law prospectively from now on, anybody that does it, but you can't punish somebody for what, right? So in a sense, to say that none of the Nevi'im got punished because they committed the sin of drinking intoxicating drink when the prohibition against doing so was given as a result of their death does raise the problem of punishing somebody for something that was not usher at the time they did it. But apparently Rashi's understanding is that even though God did not make it an explicit aveira, it should have been understood. Meaning, say, not only you were wrong in not understanding that. So that's reason number one. They were shasui yayin. They drank wine. By the way, the Gemara in Croesus has a whole bunch of ramifications from this prohibition. On the most basic level, you're not allowed to enter the Beis HaMikdash when you drink wine. That's one law. But there's another halacha as well, that a Kohen should not duchen. A Kohen does not go up for duchening, birchas Kohanim, if he has drunk wine and the wine hasn't worn off. That is actually why on Simchas Torah, actually it's not like Eretz Yisrael, we duchen all the time, but let's say in Chutz La'aretz, we only duchen on Musaf or Yom Tov. But on Simchas Torah, we duchen on Shachris, not in Musaf. Because after people get their aliyah on Simchas Torah, they often drink and they get drunk. And therefore, by the time Musaf comes along, you've had some wine. And even if you're still allowed to daven, the halacha is much more stricter. In terms of davening, and this may have been relevant to Purim, even if you're slightly intoxicated, you're still allowed to daven basically until you're virtually unconscious, in which case you wouldn't be davening anyway. So if you're tipsy or you're a little lightheaded, you are still allowed to daven, although it may not be covered to daven that way. On the other hand, a Kohen that is lightheaded, even if he's not really intoxicated, is not allowed to duchen, because we compare duchening to service in the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, that is even why, if you think about this, even though in Eretz Yisrael, or Yerushalayim at least, we duchen every day, why don't we duchen at mincha? So the Gemara says we don't duchen at mincha because mincha was commonly eaten the big meal was eaten slightly before mincha time, and people would often have wine with their meal. So by the time mincha comes along, the kohen might be in a state of shichras, a state of drunkenness, halachic drunkenness, so we only duchen shachras. That's why there's a machlokas in the Gemara. Should you duchen on a fast day, by mincha, because at that point nobody drank anything. And the Gemara's maskana is basically that we don't make a difference, meaning to say, since if we would matur duchening on a mincha of a fast day, we might come to duchen on a regular mincha, we don't do it. But it's brought down on Ne'ilah, we do, because Ne'ilah is not a prayer that corresponds to anything you do on a regular day, so no one's gonna confuse Ne'ilah, right? So Yom Kippur Ne'ilah, we actually do it. Okay, yeah.
Is the prayer to be machmir today about not duchening under the influence? Because in Eretz Yisrael, isn't Simchas Torah duchen both Shacharis and Musaf?
Yes. So one has to be careful. A Kohen has to be very careful.
So Kohanim can't drink until after they do the second duchen.
That's correct. Because of that halacha. But be it as it may, the Nadav and Avihu case was, of course, the most chamor example. By the way, the Gemara has another parallel, that one is not supposed to paskin halachic shilas when one is halachically drunk. That means even if you're a little tipsy, one has to wait. That is why there was a minhag among many rabbanim in Europe, probably some rabbanim here too, that they had two minhagim, because the problem basic was Pesach night was commonly a time of a lot of shilas, maybe a little less so today because food is processed, but when people, you know, would slaughter their own chickens and everything else, they would often find in the middle of the chicken like a grain kernel on Pesach. something that the bird had ingested. The question is, it might be chametz, and the whole chicken is chametz, is treif, and all the pots are treif, you know. So these are common shilas that are brought down in Sifrei Halacha about if you find a kernel of wheat inside of a chicken, like what's the status of the chicken, and do you assume that it's chametz? Again, today, because of processing, you tend not to find these things. But in those days you had. So many Rabbanim were in a quandary, because if you're drinking 4 cups of wine, halachically you're not allowed to paskin. So Rabbanim had 2 minhagim. Some Rabbanim would not start the Seder till several hours into Pesach to ensure that anyone that had shilas would come. But that's a big problem, because the halacha says beferish, you're not supposed to start the Seder late, because children should be able to ask questions. And of course, if it's too late, you have a problem of, you know, you have to eat the apikomen before chatzos, before the middle of the night, right? So other rabbanim had a different minhag. The Aruch HaShulchan, who was really the posek hador, the Aruch HaShulchan had a minhag of doing a super speed seder, meaning he would basically come home right after Ma'ariv, he would do his seder in a half an hour, and then he would finish the 4 cups of wine. He would then be able to take a half an hour nap. And the halacha is that if you slept a half an hour off, so the intoxication wears away. So he would finish his Seder by the time most people didn't begin their Seder yet. So he already had his nap, you know, after... what's that?
Does that still apply today? That half an hour nap is... I mean...
Yes, it doesn't seem to work, me.
It seems to me like that wouldn't always work, you know, if someone has, you know, on Purim, a large amount, and they nap for half an hour, and they wake up and they're still like, I mean, some people wake up the next morning and they still feel drunk.
Well, it would depend on how much you drank. In other words, the half an hour nap is for people who drink relatively minimally,
right?
Like the 4 cups of wine interspersed with food, etc. You know, so, right. But you're correct. I mean, if you're the more serious you are drunk, the more time you'd have to have. But anyway, people still look at the they're looking for the perfect hangover. There are many, many different suggestions. You know, there's coffee and there's lemon juice. There's all sorts of things that people say. I think I once heard years ago about you take Tabasco sauce and you put it into black coffee. I don't know. It sounds awful, but apparently it has some type of shocking effect.
Attention.
You were going to say something? Yeah.
I was going to say, isn't there, on Pesach, a lot of people have guests, right? So you should delay the meal and have guests as well, especially if they're an ani.
Well, that's very correct. It's an interesting question. You're balancing different things. On one hand, there is a mitzvah, of course, to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim.
Yeah.
And that's the mitzvah of Haggadah. On the other hand, certainly if you have guests, you know, the Chavetz Chaim's minhag was that, let's say a regular Shabbos, he would not say Shalom Aleichem or Eishes Chayil if he had Orchid. Because he said, the angels can wait. The angels aren't so hungry, and my guests are more important. So that is definitely a cheshvan. And bechlal, everything is a balance. You know, running a Seder, I don't know if any of you guys are running a Seder per se, but you will eventually. And it's a very, very difficult balance, especially when you have children, grandchildren, people of different ages. Because the types of, you know, learning and asking questions is very important. I remember I was once at a Seder years ago. As a child, and somebody was asking a lot of questions. It actually wasn't me, but some kid was asking a lot of questions. And the father was very impatient. The father said, you know, keep quiet, we got to do the Seder. Now, you think about it, the whole purpose of the Seder is that people should ask questions. I said, don't ask questions, you have to do the Seder. So, on one hand, you know, you have to have a lot of discussion, but on the other hand, the types of Torah that is interesting to one type of person is not interesting to another type of person. This is actually a yeshiva bacher problem. I mean, I went through this problem myself, that, you know, a person's learning in yeshiva, so you might have, like, very advanced types of thoughts, complicated thoughts, a pilpul to be miyajiv, let's say, especially if you're learning Pesach and Be'in. So you'll have some kasha of the Minchas Chinuch that, you know, whatever it is. And then you come and you say it, and, you know, either there are little children who don't know what you're talking about, or there are grown-ups, adults who don't know what you're talking about. And everybody's falling asleep, but, you know, you have these ingenious, you know, Divrei Torah that are so great in a yeshivish community. So you have to kind of understand that, you know, you have to have something for children, and you have to have something for adults of limited background, and you have to have something for the women. If there are other B'nai Torah, they should have something too, but be it as it may, you can't just come in and focus on what is interesting to you, when you have an achrayus to try to share the story of the Exodus with everybody according to their own. It's a difficult talent, really. It's a difficult talent to try to structure an experience that everybody can benefit from. So that would also mean not delaying the meal too much, because after all, the truth of the matter is, you can fulfill the mitzvah of talking about the Exodus after the meal too. It doesn't have to be before the meal. Meaning, it doesn't have to be in the Magid. The Magid is a part of the Haggadah that talks about the Tzias Mitzrayim, but you don't have to do all of your arichas in the Magid. You can do a quick Magid, and then talk about it during the meal, after the meal. It's actually brought down, a person should stay up as long as they can possibly stay up till they fall asleep to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. So that might be a solution for elderly people too. You know, you don't want to keep them up so late. Okay, but I want to talk a little bit about this Nadav and Avihu thing. So the first Avera that Rashi brings is Nadav and Avihu drank wine. Okay, now Chazal give us a lot of other things that they did as well, or they didn't do. Another thing they didn't do is they didn't want to get married. They were single, right? Lahavdil following the Catholic model that priests should be celibate. We'll see the connection there. A third thing Chazal say was they used to paskin halacha in the presence of Moshe and Aaron. If someone would ask a shayla, Nadav and Avihu would chap. They were big Talmidei Chachamim. They would paskin the shayla. Number four, which is somewhat related, they were known to have expressed, or at least Hashem had known them to have expressed an impatience with, when will Moshe and Aaron die, so we will take over as leaders. Of course, that's connected, of course, to paskening in their presence. A fifth, I'm not sure if I'm losing count here, a fifth one was they were not wearing the proper big day kahuna, meaning a kohen must do the avoda wearing specified garments. If anything is missing or anything is extra, the avoda is puzzle, and they're chayav misa. So a kohen cannot wear a scarf or gloves or anything like that, or even socks, because that's called extra begadim, and that renders the avoda not good. Again, I don't know how many things I mentioned. Now there is a sixth one that actually says that Nadav and Avihu were chayav misa all the way back from Matan Torah, because it mentions that they gazed at the Shekhinah and they saw the sapphire throne of God, and they were eating and they were drinking, and it doesn't say who they were, but according to one tradition, they were Nadav and Avihu. And Misa on the day of Matan Torah, but Hashem did not want to take away the joy of Matan Torah by killing Nadav and Avihu, so instead it was deferred to another happy day, but not a day as great as Matan Torah, the day of Hakamas HaMishkan. And the final Aveira that Chazal say is that Nadav and Avihu died as a result of the Chet HaEgel, meaning to say that because of Aaron's sin of the Chet HaEgel, he and all of his children deserve to die. And Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillah annulled 50% of the Gezar Din. So two of Aaron's children were spared, Elazar and Isamar, and two of those children died, really because of Aaron's sin, as a result of the Chet HaEgel. So we have no fewer than six or seven different Averos that Chazal identified. But the question is a very obvious question. The one Avera Chazal don't utilize is the Avera the Chumash itself says. I mean, what is the big mystery here? The Chumash tells us that the Avera of Nadav and Avihu was they brought a foreign fire into the temple. Now what does that mean? Let me just explain what that means. What that actually means is that if you recall, the Torah describes a fire coming from heaven that ignited the Mizbeach. And Nadav and Avihu are then supposed to take coals from that Mizbeach and that heavenly fire, and then go into the Mishkan where they would burn incense on the inner altar with the fire that was taken from the outer Mizbeach that came down from Shemayim. Instead, they brought their own fire, so to speak. They did not take the fire that came down from heaven, or at least they augmented the fire that came down from heaven with their own fire. Right? That's the simple meaning of the pasuk. And for that, they're chayav misa. So the question becomes simply this. If Chazal tell us, I'm sorry, if the Torah itself tells us what the Aveira was, why do Chazal go out of their way to offer so many alternative explanations besides the one that the Chumash itself says? So it has to be that Chazal understood that all of these Aveiros are really interpretations of what a foreign fire means. Meaning, foreign fire can mean a lot of different things. And this Aveiros in addition to the foreign fire, but these Aveiros are an explanation of what the foreign fire is. What do we mean by this? We know that fire is often a metaphor for passion, enthusiasm, commitment. Right? When a person is truly involved in something with all of his kalach, we say, you know, he's on fire. Right? Or our competition, Eish HaTorah. Okay, we're or. That's good also, Torah or. But Eish, fire, passion. All of the interesting, maybe this will tie in. Now, here is the thing. So Eish is a good thing. Eish is a good thing. Eish means commitment. Eish means passion, enthusiasm. It's connected to a love of God and a love of Torah. Now, let's look at the combination of the two words, though. Eish, fire, which is foreign, which is strange. So here is the problem that Chazal are trying to identify with all of these Aveiros. The highest level of serving God is a person who serves God with passion, enthusiasm, commitment, fire. But there's a problem in that, and that is a person who has a fiery spiritual attachment to God is often going to be impatient with the minutiae of halachic observance, because he doesn't see how the little details have any relevance to the big picture. Let's take a simple example. Now, let's say on any given day, Zman Kriya Shma of Shachris is, let's say, 8:15. And let's say the person, you know, gets up and the person needs several hours to get himself in a deep meditative state, so his Kriya Shma will be a Kabbalas Omal Chashamayim. And if he just gets up and he has to daven, you know, the regular pace and finish Shema by 8:15, it's going to be superficial, flat. It's not going to have the depth and the passion. So there's a certain attitude which you can understand, which is, you know, what's the big deal if I can say Shema at 9 o'clock with so much kavana? Isn't that worth much more than doing it by 8:15? Does God care if I do it by 8:15 instead of 8:20, if it's going to make a big difference? Or if Chaim Lezhner gives an example, he was actually criticizing Hasidus, which emphasized the internal state more than the meticulousness of halacha. An early criticism of Hasidus. It's no longer true, except for davening times. That still is true.
By who? Who was that?
No, I'm saying many Hasidim still do not.
Who was the?
Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the Vilna Gaon's Talmud. And that is, he gives an example. Let's say a person's preparing for Pesach, especially the women of the house, and they're so exhausted, they're dead tired. By the time the Seder comes along, they're depleted. They can barely keep their eyes open. And they just mumble the Seder and they go through it and that's it. What if a person were to say, you know, the whole purpose of a Seder is to be Makir Tov to Hashem, to connect to God, to feel Yetzias Mitzrayim. So I'll tell you what, I'll sleep through the night. I'll go to sleep early Pesach night. And tomorrow morning I'm going to make a magnificent Seder, a Seder that will last the whole day with enthusiasm and with joy. Now, if you looked at mitzvahs only in terms of the inner spiritual state, that would be a good point. But if you understand that mitzvahs are about obedience to Hashem, It makes no sense. Oh, now, by the way, I once gave this example in a class to some non-religious people, just to show you that life imitates art, or life can be stranger than art. You know, a woman actually said, "Oh yeah, we did that once. We once decided it was too hard to get all the family together to make a Seder the first night of Pesach. So we decided to make our Seder a week later. And it was wonderful. Everybody got together and the Haggadah was great." Yeah. So the point was, we had a much more inspirational time than when people have to rush in for Pesach and the like. So, to use a highfalutin word, the mystical, passionate personality is prone, this is a fairly big word, but I'm sure you guys have heard it, is prone to antinomian tendencies. Now, antinomian just means against the details of law, meaning the mystic is often impatient. Right? The people, let's say, you'll meet people, right, who are spiritual people. I don't say that pejoratively, I say that with full respect for what that is. But you'll find that the spiritual people, so to speak, like to focus on loving God. They like to focus on big things. But they don't want to know exactly about taking the skin off the chicken or all of these things. Why does God care about if I can rip toilet paper on Shabbos or whatever it is? I mean, that's making me closer to Hashem. Again, this is a common issue that Chos Rebbe Tshuva grappled with, and it's not an illegitimate issue. It is actually a significant issue. How do all these rules and regulations and all these different details, how do they make me closer to God? How do they make me a better person, a holier person? Again, as we get used to living the life of a Jew, we tend to ask the questions a little less, but that doesn't mean it's not a good question. It is a question that one ponders sometimes, and that is, there is the occupational hazard of being a religious Jew, that you lose sight of the forest because of the trees. You're paying so close attention to the trees, we don't see the whole picture. So this is what I mean when I say that the mystical, spiritual, passionate temperament often has a disdain and an impatience for the detail of halacha. But that's a big mistake, because ultimately it is Hashem that defines how we relate to Him. Meaning to say, it's really a contradiction in terms. It's an oxymoron to say, I will love God by making my own rules. You love and you fear God by obeying His rules, not your rules. Now, so I would suggest the following. When the Torah says, Nadav and Aviyu committed the sin of a foreign fire, this is exactly what is being described. They had a fiery passion to be connected with God. But because of this, they had a certain impatience with the boundaries and limitations that Hashem put on them. And that is called a foreign fire, because it's a fire, but it's outside of the parameters of God's command. And if you go through each of the Averis Chazal identifying, you will see how that is an expression of a deep religious passion that was not willing to be circumscribed by the limitations of divine command. Let's take Mary. Now, going back to Catholicism and some other religious movements in which they have celibacy. Why do they have celibacy? Because they teach that a person can achieve holiness only by separation from sexuality and separation from the world. Now, the Torah says not that way. The Torah says the very first mitzvah of the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. Nadav and Aviyah, however, in their desire to reach the highest levels of Kedusha, ignored the Torah's boundary that you are to marry and have a family. But it came l'shem shamayim. They thought they would achieve a higher level of holiness by celibacy, when in fact it is God's will that we create family units and engage even in sexual relations with our wife. So that was the first example. Second example, the first one is drinking wine. Same thing. Why do they drink wine? We're not assuming they were simply having a frat party, before they dedicate to Mishkan, but rather they thought that they could reach high, just like we think on Purim, they could reach higher levels of spirituality by artificial stimulants. They were seeking to escape the limits of their body and the limits of their inhibitions. But Hashem says that's not the way. In the Beis HaMikdash, you have to go with your full faculties. You don't try to cover them or impair them in any way. So that's the marriage thing, and that's the drinking of the wine. Now, paskening halacha in the presence of Moshe and Aaron, or hoping that Moshe and Aaron will die, that represents the same thing, because Moshe and Aaron represent what you might call the stodgy old guard. Moshe represents the rules and regulations. Aaron represents the protocols of kahuna. Nadav and Abihu wanted to transcend all of that. They wanted to create a relationship to Hashem that is based on feeling, based on emotion, based on love and fear, without rules, without minutiae. So when it says they were waiting for Moshe to die, it doesn't mean necessarily they wanted Moshe to die. But the type of religious worship that is exemplified by Moshe Rabbeinu was a religious worship that they wanted to supersede. They wanted to say, you can actually say they were the first Hasidim in that way. They wanted a religion that was based on passion and fire, and not based on rule and detail. Right? So that covers, let's say, that covers the wine, that covers the marriage, that covers the paskening halacha instead of Moshe and Aaron, and that covers waiting for Moshe and Aaron to die. That also covers the idea of not wearing garments, because in this, they weren't wearing all the big day kahuna. Because what are clothes? Clothes, begadim, are things that separate us from each other, meaning there's a barrier, it's a barrier. So big day kahuna suggests the idea that when you come to Hashem, there needs to be a barrier, meaning you're not God's buddy, so to speak. You have to have a certain distance, a certain respect. They had such a sense of intimacy to the divine that they wanted to get rid of barriers.
They wanted to be naked?
In a sense. Now, we don't know necessarily if they were naked. They probably didn't go that far. But the notion of not wearing begadim means that in their desire to be connected to Hashem, they didn't want barriers or limitations. Matan Torah is the same thing. If we say that Nadav and Avihu were chay of misa at the time of Matan Torah, what was their sin at Matan? They gazed, whatever that means, they gazed at the Shekhinah. Meaning to say, they looked at God in a very familiar, intimate way because of their madrega. But they didn't have a sense of boundary. They didn't have a sense of restriction. They didn't have a sense of limitation. Now the Chedo Egel, that already is a separate thing. The Chedo Egel may not fit this particular paradigm. But the point is, what Chazal are saying is, this is what we mean by Eish Zara. Eish Zara is the passion of wanting to be close to Hashem, but without a recognition of the need of boundaries and limitations. Now, the truth of the matter is, this is really a dilemma that we face in one extreme or the other. Because it is possible to have the opposite problem, where a person is a halachically observant Jew, but they're only focused on detail, and they don't think about Hashem. I remember somebody actually told me once, I was once talking about a relationship to Hashem, and I used relationship to God. So somebody said, they're not comfortable when they hear talk about a relationship to God. He says, it sounds too Christian. He says, Jews don't talk about a relationship to God. Jews talk about a relationship to Torah, which is surprisingly true, actually, but it's a mistake in some ways, because Torah has a goal. Torah does have a goal, and the goal is to connect us to a sense of the Ribono Shel Olam, to love Hashem, to revere, to be in awe of Hashem. Fear doesn't just mean fear of punishment, but it means awe, reverence. And mitzvos are supposed to bring us to a certain place. Now, certainly, it is laudatory to do mitzvos even if you don't have those emotions. Absolutely. Better to do mitzvos than not to do mitzvos. That's 100% the case. But, if a person lives on that level, there is something dry and superficial about all of that. A person should be on fire. A person should be someone that is striving to love Hashem, to have awe of Hashem. And in every mitzvah that they do, to bring that feeling in. So it is possible to have the occupational hazard of just focusing on details without seeing the big picture. But it is equally true that to have the big picture without the detail is going to be also distorting. And that is what the Torah calls Eish Zara. Now, what is very astounding and a bit controversial following, some Svarim have suggested the idea that Nadav and Avihu essentially wanted to have a private deal with God, in which, you know, God, hey, you and I are so close, you know, all of these laws don't apply to us. Kind of have a private arrangement. And what is amazing is, and this may be a partial answer for Hasidic Rebbes, that it may very well be that some individuals can have that. I mean, we don't know. In other words, we don't really know how Hashem judges Nadav and Avihu and Olam Haba. It may, in other words, the attitude that says, well, the Torah is for most people, but it may not be for me because I have my own relationship with God. Are there people that can do that? So this is the startling assertion. Maybe I shouldn't be taped here. The startling assertion is, there may be people who do have the right to do that. But those people cannot be leaders of Klal Yisrael, and those people will be taken from the world. Because they are not the people that we can follow. They are not the people that we can emulate. They are not the people that we can imitate. There may be tzaddikim who are above everything. They're above the rules. There may be, and maybe none of the Avihu were above the rules. But it's not, and that's why Aaron's Moshe says when none of them were taken that they're holier than us. But if they're above the rules, they can't be on this earth. Because the Jewish people on this earth need those rules and need those halachas and need those restrictions. Otherwise you have the anarchy of everyone doing their own thing. Okay, so that's a little bit of a commentary on the meaning of Eish Zara. And it really reminds us how we really have to combine two different aspects in our Avoda, which on some level are a bit of a contradiction. A Jew must focus on the most minutest detail of serving Hashem in the correct way. That's why we learn Halacha. That's why we're medaktik in mitzvahs. If Siman Kriya Shema is 8:15, then when you read it 8:16, you're being machriv, you are destroying worlds in ways we don't even understand. How catastrophic that is. We don't even have a sense. On the other hand, one also has to look at the mitzvos as a means to an end, and not just an end, of creating them and yiras Hashem and refining our character and making us spiritually people. Now, as I say, there's going to be a tension between those two, because the obsessive detail person will often not be cognizant of the larger pattern, and the person who focuses on the big spiritual issues tends not to care so much about the detail. But in Eved Hashem has to do both things at the same time. Okay, and that's kind of the message of the story of Nadav and Avihu. Okay, I have to finish.
Thanks so much. Thank you very much.